Hey, Tom, it's John Travolta.
Oh, hey, John.
Tom, you gotta come out of the closet. Oh, my God.
L. Ron Hubbard doesn't think I'm a great actor.
Maybe you took what he said out of context. Okay, it's like, if you don't come out, can I at least come in and talk to you?
Well, okay, but no tricks.
No tricks.
Hey, it's really nice in here.
Yeah, see?
I feel really safe. Oh my God.
Lights, camera, action. Welcome back to another episode of Happy Hour Films. As you all know, I'm Ross Bacon. I'm joined by my co-host Mike McGuigan. Mike, say hi.
How's everyone doing?
And as you should know by now, we're two dudes and drink and talk about movies. Now, we are in week two of career ender December. Last week was Kevin Costner with Untouchables and Waterworld. Tonight, though, this week we are doing John Travolta with Saturday Night Fever and possibly the worst movie ever made, Battlefield Earth. And, oh boy.
Now, I will say Travolta was like a weird one because then he, like, I feel like there was a big lull in his career in like the mid to late 80s, and he only came back with like Pulp Fiction.
Right. It was because of the sequel to this movie, basically. It was because of Staying Alive that everyone was like, yeah, I think we're done with John Travolta for a while.
but that was only a career knocker outer, not a career ender.
Right, yeah. The Battlefield Earth is what sent him straight to video purgatory and only crap after that.
Films.
And crap after that. So before we get into that, though, we got to talk about what we're drinking. So Mike, what do you got?
All right, so I was in Florida and didn't really have a chance to go beer shopping, so we got one more. We got one more concoction this week, and I made a me beer.
Okay.
So, for those of you watching, you don't see my face, but I have a red beard, and I have, like, dark blonde, light brown hair. So, did a Rosie's Red Amber Ale from Red, White, and Brew on bottom, and I did Southward Blonde Ale with honey on top.
There you go.
Now,
that was any good?
First sip, it's solid. I mean, it's two ales mixed together, so it doesn't make some out of this world like crazy flavor. It's just two decent ales put together makes a third decent ale.
Yeah, nice. Okay. Yeah, and I, on the other hand, I have two left from my Craft a Six Pack that I did recently. One of which is an Oktoberfest. I'm going to start with that because I know that's a beer I'm actually going to like. The second one I am not entirely sure I'm going to like, and I'm saving it for Battlefield Earth simply because that's a movie that you can start off be like, oh, science fiction, and then immediately be disappointed by it. So this one I'm starting with, though, is from Left Hand Brewing. It's their Oktoberfest Marzen. And it is 6.6%, and it is very good. Left Hand is Vermont? I don't want to say Vermont. Where is it? Colorado, that's what it is. Longmont, Colorado is Left Hand Brewing. So, first taste. It's good. Very good. It's got that like darker Marzen color. It tastes just like a Marzen. It's delicious.
Oh, now, fun fact, I actually watched Battlefield Earth in a hotel lounge, airport lounge.
Nice. Everybody looking at you like, what the fuck is this guy doing? Do not let him on the plane.
God, it was an open bar.
Yeah, there you go. Do not let this man on the plane. But yeah, so we'll start off with the good one. We'll see the Scientology propaganda for the end. And the Saturday Night Fever, 1977, directed by a guy named Jod Badham or Badham. I don't know. Blue Thunder, War Games, Short Circuit, Bird on a Wire, Drop Zone, stay tuned. We will be talking about it in the future in our long form themes that we got going next year. Drop Zone will show up at one point. But this is the movie right after Carrie that John Travolta does, that is the one that everybody's like, oh, John Travolta, hot young actor, we all want a piece of John Travolta kind of thing. Like, this is the guy to pay attention to. And It really is just because of the opening scene. Like, the opening scene of this movie is so iconic. It's with the Bee Gees Staying Alive playing as he struts down the street in New York. It's, you really can't get much better than, like, as an introduction to a character than this.
Now, my favorite moment in this movie is when his dad smacks him. He goes, "Watch the hair." He's like, "I spend a lot of time on my hair, and you're out here smacking it."
Right. But what? And oh god, that whole family is ridiculous.
But $4 couldn't buy $3.
Right. Yeah. Well, what cracks me up about this opening scene is that he goes to get 2 slices of pizza, and he eats them together. I'm not talking about like biting one then the other. He puts them on top of each other and eats them as if they are one slice of pizza.
Now, I know people who do this, but there's only one scenario where it is done. And that there's a pizza place near Monmouth that has like one of those big pizzas. It's pretty thin though, and you gotta finish it in a certain amount of time to get a t-shirt. Right. Yeah, that's eating contest. That's when you eat pizza like that.
Exactly. Yeah, you don't just do it when you're casually getting 2 slices of pizza, you know? It's kind of like in Cobra when he cuts the pizza with a fucking pair of scissors. It's like, there's some pizza crimes that you just simply do not commit, you know?
Now,
that is one of them.
One time I was eating with my friends, and just to screw with them, I picked up the pizza, turned it sideways, and just took a bite out of the side.
You should have done like the California thing where they fucking roll it up or some shit. You know, like, oh, it's like you have offended everyone.
Roll it up and eat it like it's corn on the cob.
Be great. That would make it, that'd be better than what California does, you know? But it's like, oh man, that'd be funny as hell. You know, put like the little like dogs in the end. That'd be great. But at least we do get to start this movie with a cameo from John Travolta's actual mother and his actual sister, you know? And then we are quickly taken off to the family life of John Travolta. And it's very much your typical Italian-American family. He is, I'm pretty sure, the origin of the Italian-American. Like,
This is the movie that, like, I feel like it led to Jersey Shore culture somehow. I'm not sure why, but I think it did.
No, this led to every Italian-American looking the way they do. And until The Sopranos came along, they didn't have that, like, tracksuit vibe as well. They just had, all they had was, like, the gold chains and the club gear. And then Sopranos was like, no, we can be casual, too. We can wear tracksuits. And then the Italian was just like, oh, I got my whole life here. Oh, I need nothing else but some gold chains and some tracksuits. Oh!
God. Yeah, it's not like, and then like, so I feel like this is a different type of Italian than like the mafioso you get from like a Goodfellas or a...
This is your standard Brooklyn mook is what this is. That's all this guy is. Just a Brooklyn mook who doesn't really exist anymore because of hipsters, you know, hipsters and gentrification. They've kind of pushed the Brooklyn mook out into more the Bronx and everything and like surrounding.
Yeah, yeah, you can't afford, if Captain America can't afford an apartment in Brooklyn.
Right, exactly. Yeah, how's a guy who works in a paint store, poorly, I might add, you know, he works in a paint store and yet it's like, he gets like a $4 raise or whatever it is, you know, and that's, they don't really even say if that's, he's making $4, you know,
or yeah, if he's making. $4 raise, are we talking a week, an hour,
right.
A day?
Right, an hour, what is this?
No, it's the 70s. Raise an hour, if you're working 20 hours a week, that's pretty substantial.
I mean, it is 1977, so like the minimum wage was what, 25 cents or whatever? Yeah. You could live on basically nothing back then. So him making $4 in New York was probably like, I guess, making $20 an hour now in New York, maybe? I don't know. Like, your living circumstances are probably the same as John Travolta's. You're living in this, like, rundown shithole. But you're definitely not working at a paint store making this money, you know? And if there is, you know, Home Depot's not paying you this shit. You know, this is a mom-pop, like, hardware store where you're mixing paint. But again, those don't exist anymore because of Home Depot and gentrification. But because Carhartt now is no longer for the actual working man. It's for the white hipster who wants people to think that they're the actual working man.
Or it's for, like, rednecks that grew up on their daddy's farm or something.
Right, right. And have been around people who can work with their hands. They just never actually have because...
Or your South Jersey rednecks that they're like, oh, I'm so country. I grew up 5 minutes from Camden.
Yeah, I grew up in Browns Mills. Those are the true rednecks of South Jersey. Browns Mills.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're definitely, but like, you got to get to like the like real farm country South Jersey, like not Vineland, but around Vineland.
Yeah, the actual like farms that we have.
Like, like my buddy Zach, who his school got out early because one of the teacher's cows got loose and he had to wrangle them up. That is, you can claim redneck status if that happened at your school.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think you get like royalty redneck status, you know, when that happens, because that is ultimate redneck.
Your resume is almost cowboy. Like the door's open for you to become cowboy.
Yeah, you don't need to go through like the initial training. You're basically in like the 201 classes of cowboys.
You're almost like, if cowboys are fraternity, you're almost a legacy if you get out of school because your teacher's cows got out.
Right. Well, the irony is that if you're going to school, that's a strike against you as a redneck, you know? You're educated, which is a problem. You can't be that. But what cracks me up, though, and especially, like, for 19... This is, like, when you watch old movies like this, and we talked about it with Pretty Woman with the Lotus, and that she's, like, making, like, $3,000 a week or whatever he haggles her to. And this is 1977, and we are getting a shot of a 1970 Benz. Now, that car, they say, is $8,200, which... at the time for that car is a 7-year-old used car. So that either sat on that lot for 7 years and is untouched, or it has some miles on it. Now that's the equivalent of like today's car, like a 2016, like C300, like your base ass sedan, like Benz sedan, costing $41,000, which is absolutely hilarious. Because if it has year-appropriate miles, like around 60K, it should only be about $24,000. So the amount of, like, upcharge on this Brooklyn Benz is pretty great.
Well, now hang on. In our current economy, used cars hold value like never before. So maybe maybe there was a chip shortage.
Right. Yeah, that gasoline shortage in the 70s really got to them. Yeah, Jimmy Carter is absolutely like, you know what? These car prices are out of control. You know, this $8,200 7-year-old car? No. that will not stand. But it is pretty funny because Travolta is a Jersey guy. He's from Englewood, which is up across the water from the city. And so his Brooklyn accent, it's actually pretty good. It's actually pretty good. So, like, when he talks, you're like, oh, okay, yeah, this is definitely it. But the one that really fucks me up, though, is when, what's her name, Stephanie? It's when Stephanie starts to put the accent on, and you're like, oh, Karen Lingorney, you are absolutely an L.A. girl pretending to be from Brooklyn. this is bad, sister. You really got to stop this. We should have just made, like, there's got to be a line where, like, you're a transport plant from L.A. That's why you don't have this accent. So that's all we need.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, watching this movie, I'm just like, this was the first time I actually watched this movie. And
it's the first time I've seen it all the way through.
You know, the idea of disco being his escape, just, I'm clearly the wrong generation, but it did not sync with me.
Well, that's the thing. You know what this soundtrack was? At the time, this soundtrack was the highest selling album of all time.
Oh, yeah. I actually did know that. And
yeah, I mean,
major props to like the Bee Gees and stuff like that.
I mean, you have to admit, of all the garbage disco music that's out there, the Bee Gees are like the top of the, they're the good stuff.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, they're the gold standard. They're the platinum standard of disco.
Yeah, and then it's like ABBA is like right under that, and you're like, okay, so like the songs in this movie, you're like, ah, the Bee Gees, I can listen to this. If ABBA was thrown in here, like I can listen to this too. But then if you get like the other garbage that was thrown out there, it's kind of like when the hair metal craze of the 80s happened. It's like you have your Poisons, you have your others, and then you get your like your Slaughters and your Kicks and your Damn Yankees. Like you get all of these bands, like, and then you get Faster Pussycat. You get all these bands that make the same music. They just don't make it as well. Like Motley Crue and Poison and all that are up there. This is like ABBA and the Bee Gees are the top. And then the rest is like just filler. That's all it is. And thankfully, that's not really here.
Now, this movie did make me think of the American Dad episode. Stan goes back in time and leaves like his disco hits of the 70s tape. And Roger the Alien finds the tape and starts the disco movement.
Yeah, there you go. And then that's the thing. This movie, though, kind of also started every genre of music gets its like defining movie kind of like standard, where like this was for disco. And then, of course, you get like, I'm just going to fast forward to the ones that everyone probably knows. It's like you get your Save the Last Dance, and then you get your, you know, your Magic Mike's, maybe, you know, for like stripper hip hop dancing, you know, and all like Bring It On.
I think some people might have gone with Step Up.
Oh, yeah, Step Up and all that shit. Yeah, whatever. But it's like each one you have the same thing. Then, of course, there's like for rock, there's kind of like, all right, so Mark Wahlberg tried, he was rock star, right? And then there's, of course, Airheads, which is classic, but it's not like this is
Final Tap.
Final Tap, yeah, this is closer to Airheads in the sense that our main character is kind of an idiot, he's a sympathetic idiot up until a point. And then our boys in Airheads, we love them the whole way, but they're like, they're lovable morons, you know, and they're playing, their life is a specific genre of music that they live for. And for the Lone Rangers, it's obviously playing the music. And for John Travolta, it's dancing to the music because he can get away from everything else in his life. And it's like, okay, this is fine. I'm with you. And then he starts to interact with people that aren't his buddies. And you're like, oh boy, it's very hard to kind of like this dude after a while, because he is such a complete piece of shit to Annette.
My god, when he's like, who is that guy to you? Like,
he ruins Annette's life.
Yeah,
the girl that gets raped twice. He ruins her life because all she wants to do is just dance with him a couple times and maybe, you know, bang him once or twice. I mean, she's not really looking to be his girlfriend, but she definitely just wants to kind of fucking dance. That's all she wants to do. But he wants nothing to do with her because, like, she's just the lowest form of life, apparently, to him. And no, we don't really even know why. And then there's Stephanie in this, who, she's kind of the, like, foil to Travolta because she's the way Travolta is to others to Travolta. You know, Travolta is a piece of shit to people that aren't his buddies. And he's kind of even an asshole to his buddies. But Stephanie is to Travolta. She just looks down on this dude. She wants nothing to do with this guy because she thinks he's beneath him. But then the funny part is, now, when she starts to pull, like, the high road gag, like, stuff with him, like, the I'm high and mighty kind of thing, she starts to explain what her job is. And if I got the impression of her job correctly, which I think I did, all she does is get coffee for people at an office building that has celebrities occasionally stopping by it. Or it's some sort of, like, casting agency or some sort of, like representative agency. But she's not an agent. She's not an actress. She's just the gopher. She's the one that gets the coffee. She's the one that gets the car keys. She's the one that, when somebody needs their ass wiped, she's the one that wipes it. You know, it's like, your job is so insignificant to the greater world that for Travolta to work in a paint store for $4 an hour, helping the local neighborhood with this little mom and pop hardware store, he is absolutely better than you in every possible way.
So it's weird because in scenarios you're like, oh, Travolta's humble, and like when he gets the raise, he's like, oh man, he's like, you're giving me a raise. Like, it doesn't matter how much.
Right, exactly. And he even does pull like, come on, I'm taking the afternoon off. Like, I never take an afternoon off, boss. I'm always here on time. I'm the model employee. I don't care what you say. I'm taking the afternoon off. And the guy's like, well, I'm going to fire you, whatever. He's like, well, fuck you, man. I'm out of here. And then, of course, he goes back, like, the next day as if nothing. Pulls a George Costanza. It's like, as if nothing happened. He just goes back in. And the guy's like, look, Emperor's got a little hot. Both said some things you didn't mean. You're back on the team, you know? It's like, you were never actually fired. You know, hope you enjoyed your afternoon. And it's like, all right, there's at least that relationship. But then there is the turn. And the turn with this character is when he attempts to rape Stephanie. And yes. I was like, oh, we almost had it. We almost had a movie in this that takes place in the 70s that didn't have our main character trying to rape somebody. Then that is right before his friends successfully rape Annette. And I was like, oh man, what are we doing? Does this need to happen? I don't think this needs to happen. It would serve the plot better if she killed herself, you know? If she committed suicide, like their buddy, who, quote-unquote, accidentally dies. No, he definitely killed himself. But that would be a much better plot point than these two dudes who we're supposed to think are his little, like, his bosom buddy goofball pals turn into fucking rapists. And I was like, ow! This is bad.
Yeah, I know, because like this is supposed to be like you're supposed to watch a 19-year-old try to figure his way through life and have dance as an escape. Well, now I'm rooting against the fucker.
I want his life to be ruined. And then there's that other weird plot line. Well, there's two weird plot lines that are
his
happening.
His brother being a priest and quitting.
Okay, three plot lines then. I forgot about that entirely. Yeah, his brother is like the golden child. His older brother, he's a priest, but he's quitting the priesthood, and that apparently is ruining his mother's life. Like, she is completely on edge now. She's borderline going to kill herself, all this shit.
No, that plot line did deliver, like, my favorite conversation of the movie. She's like, I need you to take me down to pray. He's like, you just went to church in the morning. He's like, yeah, but I need to pray for your brother to call me. He's like, why don't you just call him? He's like, no, he's my son. He should call me. He's like, you're turning God into
a switchboard operator. You're turning God into a switchboard operator. That was a great line. I was laughing at that. But the funniest thing is that this brother, who is like Frank Jr., because the father is Frank Sr., he looks like... I'm trying to think. Oh God, I'm trying to get the actor's name. He looks a lot like Jason Miller. Now, Jason Miller's most famous role is as the priest in The Exorcist. And what cracked me up is when he came on screen, I was like, this is 4 years after The Exorcist. It would be pretty great if this was like a somehow sequel to The Exorcist. Now, granted, in The Exorcist, the priest does kill himself. No, it's to save Reagan. So if he somehow survived and had to go, like, had obviously because of that interaction that he had with Reagan and the whole exorcism, he's like, you know what? I'm done being a priest. And then he goes home to his house in Brooklyn and he happens to be John Travolta's older brother. Like, that would have been fun.
Did he also vaguely remind you of Chrissy in from The Sopranos?
A little bit, yeah. He's a little less rat-like than Mold, Christopher Moltisanti. You know, think of the damn actor's name.
Michael Imperioli.
Imperioli, that's what it was. Yeah, Imperioli. Hey, he's a little less ratty than Brioli, but yeah, there is that. But then the other two plot lines are the buddies are constantly in this like background gang war with the local Puerto Rican gang. And at one point, one of their buddies, who I'm not entirely sure we actually meet in the movie, he gets beat up by this gang. And it's apparently because he said that, and I quote, all he said was greaseballs and spick dicks under his breath, and they laid into him. And it's like, yeah, of course we did, because he flat out insulted them for no reason. So yes, these dudes kicked his ass, you know? It makes perfect sense. You didn't need to go after them.
But I was waiting for the dance fight to come, because this is just moderately, in terms of gang warfare, this is moderately more realistic than West Side Story.
West Side Story, yeah, exactly. And it's basically West Side Story, too, you know? But
I mean, they even have Tony.
Exactly. It's like, and these guys take that as, like, the ultimate offense. It's like, as if their buddy wasn't the one that got his ass kicked, you know? That wasn't the one that started everything, got his ass kicked. So they drive their car through a building into like a clubhouse, basically, or into a bar, and they get into this melee with this Puerto Rican gang, and then they run away, and that's done. Like, we're just done with that now. There's no repercussions after that. We're done. But then there is the ultimate what is happening with this character storyline, which is, I think the character's name is Bobby, I think. He's the one who is constantly the entire movie trying to get advice on what to do with his now pregnant girlfriend. And he wants to know, should I marry her? Should we get an abortion? Can the Pope get me a special, like, letter of whatever so I can get an abortion and still be a good Catholic or whatever? That is a legitimate question that he asked the brother at one point.
Listen, he was pulling a Henry VIII.
Wait, so he didn't start his own church. But it's, yeah, Bobby is the character, Bobby C. And the funniest thing is, like, this story that's happening in the background of this movie is arguably more interesting than what's happening with our main characters.
Absolutely. And then, like, even when he's like, come on, we'll talk. He's like, you didn't want to talk.
And that's the other thing. He ends up like going off the edge because Travolta forgets to call him back at one point. And it's then they always do this thing where they like they fuck around the Brooklyn Bridge and they're just like hanging off at like goofballs or whatever. Well, this dude is like legit suicidal at one point and he's kind of dancing around and then he turns it's like dancing around, he's happy go lucky, and then all of a sudden it turns and he's like yelling at Travolta. He's like, you could have just called me back, you never called me back. And then it's like, oops, I fell. No, oops, he jumped, and he definitely killed himself. And we do breeze past that a little bit too quickly, I think. Now, granted, this movie is not very long, and it's almost the perfect length it needs to be at just under 2 hours. But I could have taken a couple more minutes to let John Travolta's character, like, live with this a little longer. Because it is after this that he does kind of say, like, you know what, fuck my life. You know, I'm sick of this shit. I'm changing things around, you know. I'm going to move to Manhattan somehow on $4 an hour or $4 a week. I don't know.
Potentially. We don't know.
We don't know what his salary is. It's just $4 more than what it was at the beginning of the movie.
And we don't know by what increment. Like, we don't know if it's $4 more an hour, a day, a week, a year.
Somehow $4 factors into being a larger amount than whatever is presently his salary.
I used to make $8 a year. Now I make $12.
Oh, shit. But it's funny as hell because I'm like, this entire storyline with Bobby is pretty great because I kind of want to see a smaller part of this movie, like where we get a sidetrack, like we get a little sidetracked. Where the brother, on his last day of being a priest, writes a letter to the Pope saying, my brother's friend Bobby accidentally got his girlfriend pregnant. They're not married. Can he have a special whatever from, like, signed by you so he can get an abortion? And then I want a scene where, like, the Pope gets that. Like, he gets that letter. He's reading it. He's considering it. And then he just goes, this kid, and throws it out. And then we're back to the movie again. That would be great. But then, of course, there is,
Wait. That wasn't a new idea, though. I mean, the entire Protestant church came about because the Catholics were selling indulgences to forgive sins.
Yeah. I mean, this kid, he could have just converted. You know, that's all he had to do. Yeah,
no, really. I mean, no, he didn't have to convert. The Catholics are who did that. If he was Protestant, he'd have been fucked. But Catholic. Yeah,
true. But, I mean, and still, you know, it's, again, it's all an imaginary, but it's a different imaginary man in the sky than the one that Travolta worships in his next movie. But it's one of those subplots in this movie, ostensibly about a guy who loves to dance to disco music. That you're like, wait, now we have rape and we have suicide and a weird plot line about a guy trying to get an abortion. What's happening to this movie? Like, what is happening here? I don't know where we went off the rails, but we did. And it somehow is brought all back. Like, it's kind of forgiven simply because of the dance competition that they have, which is perfectly parodied in Airplane a couple years later. So it's like Untouchables with the train scene and Naked Gun. It's almost all worth it simply for the parody that we get. You know, and it's the sequel to this, though, is where I'm pretty sure everyone was kind of like, okay, John Travolta round one can probably end, you know, because after this,
you have
movie,
to end Pretty Boy John Travolta before you get to
absolutely
90s vaguely action star John Travolta.
Right. So after this is his run after this. We got Grease immediately after this, which most people would argue is probably the one that was like Travolta, household name. And then we get Welcome Back, Kotter, which is the other one that people are like Travolta, household name. He's an urban cowboy. He does Staying Alive in 83. And everyone's kind of like, okay, this is weird. Because I think Tony in that one, I think becomes... he's trying to get on Broadway or something like that. Like, that's his move when he gets to Manhattan. And then there's a movie called Perfect, which I might make you watch, Mike, because it's him and Jamie Lee Curtis in, like, an 80s aerobics class. And you've probably seen the meme where they're, like, aggressively staring at each other while, like, gyrating their hips in the class. Yeah. Perfect is what that's from. And then we got Look Who's Talking in 89, and everyone's kind of like, all right, Look Who's Talking 2 is around the corner. Okay, what are we doing? And then Look Who's Talking Now. So now he's full on in talking baby movies. And then 94 happens, and Tarantino's like, you know what, John? I got a role for you. And that's how Pulp Fiction brings him back. And then, of course, he does
Get
Shorty.
And you eventually get, like, Face Off and...
Get Shorty, Broken Arrow, Phenomenon, unfortunately, does Michael. Face Off, Primary Colors, Thin Red Line, General's Daughter, which was... Everybody was kind of like, it's all right, it's not terrible. But then, in 2000, he goes and does it. And it's the next movie we're going to talk about. But before that, Mike, what are you drinking? Like, how's your beer?
All right, it's one of the better mixtures. This one is not an abomination. Like, where a lot of the beers I mix, it's like you get like the fused animals like Mephisto makes in South Park, where it's like an elephant and a pig or something, or a monkey with multiple asses. This is more like a mule, where it's like the two animals are close enough to make a cohesive animal that's pretty good.
All right, yeah.
So yeah, Rosie's Red Amber Ale from Red, White, and Brew, and then Southward Blonde Ale with Honey from Departed Souls.
Departed.
I'm not gonna say they need to do like a collaboration, because I feel like either one could pretty much make this beer on their own. Like, this is not a unique flavor, but it's a good flavor.
All right. And then, yeah, my left-hand Oktoberfest is really good. That was delicious. Now, we have moved on to something I'm sure will probably be good the first taste, and then after that, I'm going to want to kill myself. I have Salt and Sand. Now, I don't know. Okay, so here we go. Craft and canned by Graft Cider in Newburgh, New York. Now, Newburgh, New York, I am very familiar with, because that's one of the places I go when I go to auction for my job. I go to car auction up in Newburgh. Newburgh's a wonderful place. It's an amazing place. It's an amazing barbecue place called Brothers, which is phenomenal. I've never been to Graft Cider. I don't know where it is in Newburgh. But this is their Agave Margarita Cider. Huh. Salt and lime. So this is ostensibly a margarita and a cider put together. Now this says this cider saves turtles, which apparently this is for supporting the Sea Turtle Conservancy. So a nonprofit with a mission of ensuring the survival of sea turtles and protection of their natural habitats, which, great cause. Sea turtles. Everybody loves them.
They look cool. Like turtles.
That's right. So I just took my first taste. I don't really know what to make of that. It's not quite a cider. It says it's a sour cider, but it's not quite a sour. It's almost as if someone didn't put enough sugar in lemonade.
Huh.
Like, it's a very, it's not a tart taste, but it's also not like a strong taste. It's kind of like it tastes like somebody didn't put enough sugar in lemonade, you know? It's fine, but it's, and I definitely won't be choosing it again. Kind of like Battlefield Earth, the Saga of the Year 3000, you know?
The comparison you just made there makes this movie sound to be mediocre, but not worth revisiting. That's horribly misleading.
Oh, it is. Yeah, I definitely oversold this movie, and I apologize to the people of Graft for comparing there too, because their cider is infinitely better, no matter what it tastes like, to Battlefield Earth, the Saga of the Year 3000. Now, if for some reason people don't know what this movie is, which, if you're not a movie person, you might not know of it. But if you're any person who knows what Scientology is, you almost certainly know about this movie, simply because it is the adaptation of the first half of L. Ron Hubbard's book of the same name. Now, Mike, you are aware that this is a book adaptation, yes?
I am.
Are you aware of what the second half of the book is about?
No.
Okay.
I've never read an L. Ron Hubbard book, but I kind of want to.
Dude, after watching this and like reading about the book, I kind of want to read this too, but it's like 1,000 fucking pages. And L. Ron Hubbard, from what I understand, is a god-awful writer. So there is no way in hell I want to read this book or suffer through 1,000 pages. But this is... Right, this is the first half. This movie tells the story of Johnny Goodboy, who is against Pearl the Cyclo and the Cyclo race, which is Travolta and the evil aliens. Now, this movie ends with Johnny saving the day, and humans can, even though they're an endangered species, they're pretty much free to take over to repopulate Earth, basically, or at least the greater Denver area. Now, the second half of this book apparently involves like intergalactic bankers showing up and trying to like, there's a lot of like bureaucracy that goes on. Now, we've talked about Harry Potter and the goblins or whatever they are in Harry Potter, which are basically J.K. Rowling's version of the Jews. Picture that, only more anti-Semitic. And that is the second half of this book. It's just a long-ass diatribe about space bankers that are trying to take over the universe. And It's a very veiled, you know, very thinly veiled reference to the Jewish people. And it's good that we're talking about it in the middle of Hanukkah. So happy Hanukkah, Mike.
Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah, Marv. But the thing with this is that the cyclos in this, of course, are from the, I'm trying to remember, it's like they're the cyclos, but they're also from, they're like the cyclotriists or something like that. So psychiatrists, basically, which Scientologists have a big problem with psychology or psychiatry. Simply because I think L. Ron Hubbard had to go to a psychiatrist at one point, and the psychiatrist accurately said he's a fucking nut job. So he clearly had to create his own religion against the entirety of that profession. But the entire, just the stupid story aside, the every aspect of this movie is bad. Every aspect. And it goes.
Was watching this. And I was like, could there be a stupider alien master race? They have to be the most incompetent alien master race I've ever seen. Now, this is an adaptation of an L. Ron Hubbard book, but it doesn't, I don't think, have anything to do with the Scientology, like the actual beliefs of Scientology to an extent.
It has nothing to do with Dianetics. No, Dianetics is like, where he lays out the Scientology, like foundations of Scientology and all that shit. Like, basically, it's like their Bible.
But this, I'm like, all right, so they've been the overlords of Earth for, it's got to be what?
1,000 years. This takes place in the year 3000, and they have controlled this planet for 1,000 years.
And they know nothing about the human animals.
Zero about the man animals.
The man animals?
Zero. Which is even funnier because the movie directly contradicts itself at one point when John Travolta takes Barry Pepper's character to the Library of Congress. Drops him basically in the center of the Library of Congress and tells him that he has read the entirety of the Library of Congress and he knows everything about human beings and how stupid they are, apparently. But during this entire movie, he has to find out what humans eat.
Yeah.
And he thinks that they eat rats simply because he sees three of them trying to survive by resorting to eating a rat.
And he also, they're like, we don't even know the language as we speak it, because they specifically speak another language.
They speak Cyclo. And apparently, yeah, and apparently and during this entire time, now it is possible to say that, okay, after 1,000 years, and apparently according to Travolta's character, the invasion and the conquering of Earth took apparently 9 minutes, is what he says. So they put up the defense for about 9 minutes. So yes, so for 999 years and you know, down to whatever 9 minutes is left, that length of time of dominating Earth, you got to figure X amount of knowledge is always lost over time.
Yeah.
So in that first 10 years, you probably know nothing about the people you've conquered simply because you've killed them too quickly. And the people that are left, you are taking over everything and making it yours. So you're not bothering to learn about these people. Now, again, now presumably they don't say how old Volta is, but if he's had the time to read the entirety of the Library of Congress, it's probably more than a few years. This is 1,000 years from the conquest. He has had the time to read the Library of Congress. He has presumably had the time to fill the learning machine that they have with the knowledge of the universe, which includes Cyclo, English, Euclidean geometry, apparently astrophysics, and how to fly a jet, shit like that. And that he knows all this. But he doesn't know all this at the same time. Like,
now, we have to... There's a vague historical parallel that could be drawn here to an extent. So John Travolta decides to train this human to fly and whatnot so that they can dig up the gold. John Travolta is the CIA, and the humans are Osama bin Laden.
Very much done the same way as 9/11. They end up commandeering a bunch of jets. They end up destroying the main building of the cycle of race. So, yes.
they say the Simpsons, there have been so many shows that they're like, oh, they predicted 9/11. No one ever gives credit to L. Ron.
That's right. L. Ron and Battlefield Earth, you know, John Travolta, they all predicted 9/11. Because, yeah, this came out in 2000. This was a year before 9/11. So it's probably because everyone who's seen this movie immediately wants to forget it. So there's no way that Battlefield Earth was the first thing about predicting 9/11. It's definitely The Simpsons, you know. But then just the historical accuracy, or no, just the factual inaccuracy of 1,000-year-old jets and jet fuel and nuclear warheads. Now, granted, the only realistic aspect of this entire movie is that the nuclear material in those warheads would still be good. It would still be good. But everything else around it that would cause it to detonate and be an active bomb would be completely useless at this point.
The other thing is, their entire planet's radioactive. Like, no one's ever lit a small fire that apparently would just light everything up. Like, when all the trees repopulate in Futurama and Bender lights a match.
Right. Yeah. And it's even funnier because it's just the production of this movie was so shitty that Scientologists and their various goons were present at all times, like just kind of like fucking with shit all the time, just to be the Scientology pricks that they are, those fucking alien worshiping nut jobs. And so when you look at just the opening scene of this movie, Johnny Goodboy is hunting, his father has died. He is going to hunt to kill the monster, apparently, that's been frightening the village people. Not the group, that would be even better. But the people of the townspeople. Now, when he goes out there, it's the middle of the day. He goes out and he stumbles across this monster. Now, this monster happens to be a dinosaur left over in a miniature golf course. He is in the middle of a miniature golf course that is fully intact, mind you, but is only kind of covered by a couple like things of moss. That's about it. And he can easily wipe those things away. This is, again, presumably has been 1,000 years since the last time this miniature golf course was used. And the cyclos have not done anything to it. They have just let it go to rot. So we either have the greatest craftsmanship anyone's ever seen in the universe, that over 1,000 years, these paper mache dinosaurs do not, or like plaster dinosaurs, do not crumble, do not lose their color. They don't even chip. You know, these things are basically as they were 1,000 years before. So it's just right off the bat, you're like, okay, we got to throw a lot more grass or something on this, make this thing falling apart, do something. But then you just get down to the basic technical camera work of this movie. The entirety of the movie is in a Dutch angle. Now, if you don't know what a Dutch angle is, a Dutch angle is when you take the camera and you cut it. There isn't a single level shot in this entire movie. And the reason for that, allegedly, is that the director, Roger Christian, a complete moron, said that he wanted the movie to look like a comic book, which this is based off of a novel. So why do you want it to look like a comic book? B, it's a movie not made from a comic book, so what are you doing? And then C, you do know that a Dutch angle is supposed to make you feel uneasy about the shot, right? It's supposed to give you a visual cue that something is not right here. So to do your entire movie in a Dutch angle, you're basically subliminally telling your audience that nothing is right here. You should not feel good about watching this movie.
Or you're telling your audience that your cameraman was like, this is the right side up, right?
Right, right. If I was a cinematographer of this movie, or even came anywhere near working a camera in this movie, and people asked, what did you work in Battlefield Earth? I'd be like, yeah, but I vehemently fought to make this the shots level. I was overruled at every turn.
I bought the director a level for Christmas, and he hit me right in the face.
He shoved it up my ass. And so after that, I kind of had to walk funny, but I didn't work with Scientologists again, I can tell you that. And then there's just the other things about, like, the dialogue. We're constantly referring to humans as man animals. We're talking about cameras and calling them picto cameras. We're talking about air when it's called breath gas. And then we are saying the word crap 1,000 times, I think, in this movie. And maybe that's because it was PG-13 in the year 2000 when you couldn't just say shit all the time. But a superior alien race is just going, well, how the crap should I know? It's like, that is, it's almost like when a really Christian or religious person who doesn't curse tries to curse, and that's what they come up with. They come up with and they look over their shoulder, crap, should I know that? It's like, look, we get it. You think you're going to hell for saying the word crap? I can tell you right now, you're not.
So you there's a bunch of other things you did that you're going to hell for. Crap didn't even make the top 1,000.
Right. It's your hatred of gay people and your persecution of people that get abortions. That's what's sending you to hell. But saying crap, I don't think Kirk Cameron's going to come after you. Although he might. But then, speaking of hell, currently in the Cyclo religion, there is a hell. Because at one point, we hear that John Travolta's character is told, when you end up in hell, pause, why is there a hell still in this universe-spanning culture? We somehow have the Christian hell still? How's that possible?
Well, I mean, the concept, like, you get Helheim in Norse mythology, so maybe they have, maybe it's like the alien from Rick and Morty, where they gotta be killed by, like, a great warrior.
It was all real! It's all real!
What do you mean there was no proof? There was tons of proof!
There was so much proof! And it's,
which they are the most, like, trigger-happy species in the galaxy, so, like, if that was their belief system, it would make sense.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the other thing. They have these guns that are always set to, like, phaser, like, to stun. But there is a kill setting that's only used, like, once. And then just the idea.
It's mostly used on cows.
Yeah. Oh, okay. And the fact that we cut away from him blowing those cows' legs off is fucking horrifying. That's the most offensive thing about this movie. When John Travolta is picking those cow legs off of those cows, and we see one kind of fly off before the camera cuts. I need to see them all. I need to see ground beef at the end of that.
And I need, like, that he was just shooting one foot out from them, so the cows are just falling over. They're not dying right away.
I need to see that. It's so funny.
But I also needed a lot of moves in the background.
You need something. You need something to be happening. And what's even stranger is the general plot of the movie. Travolta wants humans to do his slit to labor to, because apparently gold for some reason is valuable to these people. I'm not entirely sure why it would be, but gold is valuable to them. So after hooking Johnny up to the Barry Pepper's character, up to the learning machine, it basically teaches him the entirety of the knowledge of the universe. So now he knows that it's supposed to be the techniques of giving him the Cyclo language and how to mine gold. But why wouldn't you just set it to those two things? Why would you let him learn Euclidean geometry and all this other garbage? And then he, of course, uses that knowledge to now stage a revolt. And it's, why would you, if you have conquered the universe, apparently, and yet you're too stupid to treat your quote-unquote man animals as if they are animals and just teach them the basic things that you need them to do. Because then what Johnny does, what Barry Pepper's character does, he steals a jet, he goes to Fort Knox, and he gets the gold bars from Fort Knox and brings it back. Now,
did you tell, he read the entire Library of Congress and didn't learn that there was a fort with tons of fucking gold?
Exactly. Like, there is so much. This, the Swiss cheese plot holes in this movie are like, there's barely any connective tissue. It's nothing but holes.
That's what I was saying. With teaching one person all this information, if you allegedly knocked out the entire human race when they were wet, like when you had a bunch of people who were capable at using weapons and stuff in 9 minutes, yeah, I wouldn't be worried about one person learning this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And but that's the thing. 9 minutes. You took out the entirety of the human army. Like, I'm not just talking American army. I'm talking human resistance force. The human military force in 9 minutes. And it takes you all of 30 minutes, I'd say, to undo all of that by teaching one of them the secrets of the universe. And it cracks me up because it's like, it's almost as if he didn't want to succeed. It's almost as if Forrest Whitaker's character should have been like, wait, are you subliminally, like, are you, like, subconsciously sabotaging yourself? Are you trying to get us all killed? And then Travolta does his, like, the thing that he does this entire movie, which is, he says, no, I'm not trying to do that, but I will do that, you know? It's free. He always starts every sentence by saying, no, I'm not going to do that. And then the second half of the sentence is him saying, but I will do that, you know, in some form or another. So I would want to at least want one scene where Forrest Whitaker's like, are you trying to get us, like, killed? And then he goes, you know what? I think I am, actually. I don't want to be here for another 50 cycles or whatever the guy punished me for because I fucked the senator's daughter. I don't want to do that anymore. So I'm going to completely sabotage us.
When he tells him, he's like, this was supposed to be a temporary assignment. He's like, we're putting you on for, I forget what they call it, but they repeat the line like 50 cycles. Times.
So it's five cycles or whatever. And he's like, no, maybe 50 cycles, or maybe it'll be an indefinite assignment or something. It's like, all right. And then of course, where Saturday Night Fever and Welcome Back, Kotter for John Travolta kind of gave everybody the John Travolta impression, where it was like the, oh my God, like, oh my God, it's John Travolta, oh my God, like that. Like, yeah, it looks like that. That's kind of like the John Travolta impression up until this point.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Face Off, he does it when he's Nick Cage. And then in this movie, he does it so much more. And that's the John Travolta talking normally and then saying something like this, you know? And he does that so much in this movie. He's almost as if he's parodying himself. But then you remember that this is his passion project for Scientology and the overlord L. Ron Hubbard. And you're like,
L. Ron, oh my God.
Oh my God, L. Ron. Well, what's even funnier than this is that Tom Cruise was actively, like, against this movie ever being made. Tom Cruise, the face of Scientology in Hollywood. And he was like, no, we shouldn't do this. This is a bad idea.
Which, he's right.
Absolutely. Tom knows blockbusters, and he knows what works. Some of his movies might not hit on all cylinders, but at least they're mostly entertaining. And Tom Cruise has a very strong track record of movies, whereas John Travolta, his misses are bad.
Tom Cruise went into the closet.
He's in a closet. Now I'm in a closet, too. But John Travolta's misses are big misses, and they are massive failures. And this movie is one of the biggest failures of all time. And it's completely insane because he also dragged his poor wife into this.
Yeah.
Because she is like an alien. She's a cyclo hooker, basically. And The weird thing is that the line that she has, because apparently she has a very long tongue that she's very good with, so I guess she's good at eating ass or something like that. But the line that she has is, I'm going to make you as happy as a baby cyclo on a straight diet of Kerbango. Kerbango is the alcoholic drink that they drink. So, my question is, what? How the fuck will her giant tongue, presumably snaking up his asshole, make him feel like a drunk baby? And why is that a good thing? And like, why is that the thing that you should aspire to?
Yeah. Yeah, he basically has his wife play alien Gene Simmons.
Essentially, yeah. Yeah, except Gene has prices. Like, he has a price on his dignity. I don't think she does. But, I mean, and R.I.P. Kelly Preston, this is the second time in like a month we've tried to talk about her being a fucking weird sex hound, you know? But this one's especially bad because it's to her husband.
Yeah.
And she's like an alien hooker, as opposed to just fucking, again, another Scientologist, as opposed to just fucking Tom Cruise and Jerry Maguire. But it's like, she's an actual character in that movie. But in this, she's a blink and you miss it cameo. And if you don't know it's her, I guess good for her that people probably wouldn't recognize her from it.
If you don't know it's her, she's probably happy about it.
Yeah, she's probably very happy to know that people didn't know it's her. But it's this entire movie. It's no wonder that after this movie, John Travolta's career was very much like radioactive for this movie. Like, nobody wanted to touch him. And it's kind of crazy that it even got to the point where at the Oscars that one year, he could refer to Idina Menzel as the wickedly talented Adele Dazeem and then try to like kiss her face or some shit. Like, he pulls that weird perv shit at the Oscars that one year.
Yeah.
But like, look, here's what he does after Battlefield Earth. He somehow manages to get Swordfish out, which is a great movie. It's kind of a stupid hacking movie, but it's still a good movie. Then there's something called Domestic Disturbance. Then there's when he plays Austin Powers. He's in Austin Powers Goldmember. And then he did that movie Basic. And then he's the villain in the Thomas Jane Punisher movie. Ladder 49. Be Cool, the terrible sequel to Get Shorty. Lonely Hearts, looks like a Salma Hayek movie that no one saw. Wild Hogs, I don't think you get worse than Wild Hogs. He comes back in Hairspray, and everyone in Hairspray was kind of like, hey, this might be, this is like Eddie Murphy in Dreamgirls. Like, this might be him coming back. And then he does Bolt. And then he does the Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 remake. Which I believe he says, lick my bunghole, motherfucker, in that movie. I think he might say it to one of his henchmen or even Denzel in that movie. But it's not good. And then Old Dogs. Savages. Killing Season. Now I'm at the point where I don't know what these movies are. And he did The Forger. Criminal Activities. Andrea Bocelli, Now We Are Free, where he plays himself in a 4-minute short. So at least there's that. Then In the Valley of Violence. Okay, so then American Crime Story happens. Now that's the Ryan Murphy FX OJ drama, like dramatized series, where like David Schwimmer was Robert Kardashian. Well, John Travolta plays Robert Shapiro. In that series, he's pretty good. But then he does something called I Am Wrath. Then he does Gotti, which is one of the worst movies ever made. Speed Kills. Grading Paint. The Poison Rose. The Fanatic, which The Fanatic is where everyone should have been like, you know what? I think John Travolta's career is over. Because do you know who directed The Fanatic, Mike?
No. I don't know what The Fanatic is.
The Fanatic... And I will read its IMDb synopsis. A rabid film fan stalks his favorite action hero and destroys the star's life. Now, I believe the action hero that he's stalking is played by our good friend Devon Sawa. But this is kind of the level that Devon Sawa would do. Like, Devon Sawa is the kind of guy that I feel like if you ask him, he'll do your movie. simply because he seems like a nice dude. But John Travolta probably did this movie because he was approached as the main character, and he's like, oh, anti-hero, whatever, I can do this. Like I said, directed by Fred Durst. Yes. Limp Bizkit's Fred Durst.
Oh, God.
The man who did it all for the Nookie. The man who, as Mike said, kept rolling, 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 would do it for the Nookie and would break your fucking face tonight. That was the man who directed this John Travolta movie. And then, of course, he does, now he does the, he does Paradise City, Die Hard. I don't know what that is, but it's a Kevin Hart movie. He does Mobland, which you can't get away from because it's on, if you have Amazon Prime, when you turn it on, it's like the a big ad that they show first. And there's something called The Shepherd, which is some 38 minute something or other. But now you can also see him in Capital One ads as basically his staying alive, his Saturday Night Fever character, only as Santa. And I think once you start playing Santa versions of your more famous characters, I'm pretty sure your career is done. You could probably just stop. We don't need you in Hollywood anymore. We don't need you in movies anymore. The only other option is to start playing parody versions of yourself and things that are like tongue-in-cheek, wink-wink, don't you get the joke kind of versions. But I don't think... John Travolta, he kind of does that with this Santa role. But still, he's... It's funny because the most entertaining thing he's done recently is do an interview with Preston and Steve on WMMR that was legitimately funny. And he seems like a really nice guy. So you wonder, what the fuck happened? You know? What the fuck happened, dude? It's like, you seem to have all of the necessary things that people want who want to work with you. That you don't make those right decisions. You're doing movies with Fred Durst, for Christ's sake. Like, what is happening?
And you don't have the pure charm and charisma of the man who will come at the end of the month that exactly. to be able to make those decisions and bounce right back.
Exactly. It's quite shocking. And you could really do, I'm sure you could do a very deep, like sociological study, I'm sure, of how one of our most beloved actors for so long somehow fell so far so fast, you know? And it's very, very odd. Because Kevin Costner, the man, like I said, on our episode about him, he's like a pair of pleated khakis watching off-white paint dry. He's a boring dude. And he has his moments of being like, you know what? This is kind of entertaining. But with John Travolta, you're like, okay, this is entertaining. Where did John Travolta go? Hey, he's back in Pulp Fiction. Where did John Travolta go? Oh, he's back in Face Off. Where did John Travolta go? Oh my God, what the fuck is Battlefield Earth? Where did John Travolta go? You know, it's like, why does he keep coming back with these spectacular failures or these spectacular movies, you know? They're either great or they're not awful. It's like,
there's no in between with him.
Right, there's no in between. It's like, how does he keep doing this?
How does he get away with it?
How does he keep getting away with this? But it's, yeah, and it's pretty insane because Battlefield Earth, despite being like weirdly, I don't know, it's weirdly makes me want to read the book just to see how bad the book is.
It's like a train wreck where I'm like, I'm curious, like, is the movie a good adaptation of the book?
Right. It's like, could this be the good, the better version of the two, you know?
Because, like, you don't have to be a good movie to be a good adaptation. Like, it might be exactly what the book is telling you.
Yeah, that would be funny if it was, like, a faithful adaptation. Like, a one-to-one faithful adaptation of the book. But it's just a shame that Elrond didn't survive to actually see the movie get made, you know? Because it was apparently, like, in talks, or at least in various stages of production since the 70s or 80s or whatever. But it's good. It's good that no one tried to make a good version of this because... I don't think it was possible. It can't be. It just can't be made. Like, this is probably as best as it gets. But so that's been John Travolta. Mike, before we talk about the next career ender, where can people find us on the internet?
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Overcast, and just about anywhere else you get your podcast from, thanks to Spotify Podcasts. You also find us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Go like and subscribe to our shit. There's a trailer out for House of the Dragon Season 2, so there's a timetable for when Game of Thrones bro comes back and makes House of the Dragon nerd's life a hell, living hell.
That's right, that's right. Oh, I can't wait to do that again. But I didn't even know the trailer was actually out. I thought that was like a fake Facebook post. Because the one I'm obsessed with right now is, have you seen the trailer for The Beekeeper?
No.
Look up the trailer for The Beekeeper, and I highly suggest everyone listening look it up too, because it's a Jason Statham January release movie, so you know it's going to be phenomenal. But it's The Beekeeper. But before everyone sees The Beekeeper in January, we do have to talk about another actor who had their career in but one stupid movie. Although in this case, it's a string of shitty movies that he just could not say no to, it seems. So we're going to talk about Eddie Murphy, who is legitimately one of the funniest people that ever lived. And we're going to start with Beverly Hills Cop, which is legitimately one of my favorite comedy movies of all time. It's such an amazing movie. It's great. Then we're going to talk about Norbit, which, oh boy, we feel Battlefield Earth is bad. I feel like Norbit's got it beat hands down. But just the ups and downs of his career, like how hot he was in the beginning and then how quickly it turned, you know, and then he's kind of come back. Like he has kind of come back, but I think the damage has been done.
Yeah, he'll never be like that, like back to where Eddie Murphy was.
Yeah, the old Eddie Murphy's never coming back. And that's probably because he's got like 9 kids or something, and he's also like a father and family man. So like, I just don't think the edge is there anymore, and he's too stuck on his like his celebrity like image, and it's just the old Eddie, the original young Eddie, was hungry and he had shit to prove, and he could give no fucks because he was Eddie Murphy. And that Eddie Murphy died at some point, and it was probably right around Norbit. And we will discuss that in detail next week. So until next week, when we talk about Eddie Murphy, I have been Ross Bacon.
I've been Mike McWiggin.
And we'll see you guys next time. So long.